Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 248. It's Monday, February 26th. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Okay, well, let's start first up with an Ohio-focused story. This from statenews.org. Statewide dashboard of data to help Ohioans select nursing homes goes live. A new state tool to research and weigh different nursing communities around Ohio went live last Wednesday. Governor Mike DeWine and Ohio Department of Aging Director Ursel McRoy announced. The Nursing Home Quality Navigator is an online database that indexes federal and state data about Ohio's hundreds of long-term care facilities. It is searchable by location and by individual nursing home. A profile on each place features its Medicare and Medicaid star ratings, details its bed numbers and staff ratio, and flags whether it has been cited for abuse, among dozens of other data points. It also allows users to weigh locations side by side. McElroy said, "What's on the dashboard is not new information, it's just now being put together in one place publicly. I think it's unfortunate if there's ever a time when someone needs to make this life-changing decision and that information isn't just there, or it's not there in a way that can be easily searched to make an informed decision," she said. "That's what we're looking at to do here. The idea came as a recommendation by a governor's task force looking into Ohio's nursing homes and long-term care facilities." DeWine said task force members often heard that information about communities for the state's elderly population was too scattered to be beneficial. Well, here at Just for the Health of It, we're data freaks. We love information, but of course, information is only as good, as accessible, and digestible as it is. So, way to go, state of Ohio. Make something a little bit more digestible, and hopefully that'll make people make that difficult and complicated choice just a little bit easier. Okay, well, next up, let's get back to the basics with a pillar of health, and that would be sleep. This from Medical Express. Wake-up call for us to establish regular healthy sleeping patterns. It's official. Getting the recommended 7 to 9 hours of sleep a night is currently out of reach for almost one-third of the population. As a Flinders University study found, 31% of adults had average sleep durations outside the recommended range. The global study of thousands of adults published in Sleep Health found only 15% of people slept the recommended 7 to 9 hours for 5 or more nights per week. And among those who did achieve an average of 7 to 9 hours per night over the 9-month monitoring period, about 40% of the nights fell outside the ideal range. The paper is titled, "Are We Getting Enough Sleep? Frequent Irregular Sleep Found in an Analysis of Over 11 Million Nights of Objective In-Home Sleep Data." This is crucial because regularly not sleeping enough, or possibly too much, are associated with ill effects, and we're only just realizing the consequences of irregular sleep, said Flinders University researcher Dr. Hannah Scott. "Clearly getting the recommended sleep duration range frequently is a challenge for many people to achieve, especially during the working week." The Flinders Research Group used sleep tracker data collected by an under-mattress sensor to examine sleep durations over the 9-month period in almost 68,000 adults worldwide. Sleeping less than 6 hours on average per night is associated with increased mortality risk and multiple health conditions, including hypertension, obesity, and heart disease. Less than 7 hours of sleep and more than 9 hours of sleep a day has been linked to adverse health and well-being, including digestive and neurobehavioral deficits. Female participants generally had longer sleep durations than males, and middle-aged people recorded shorter sleep durations than younger or older participants. Given what we know about the importance of sleep to health, we also need to assist people to resolve chronic sleep difficulties and encourage all people to make sleep a priority. So there you go, a pillar of the health that's got a lot of chips in it. So another thing to focus on, establishing regular habits and healthy sleeping patterns. Okay, well, next up, let's get to a couple stories about the menthol-flavored smoking ban, federal ban, that's in play here. First up from CNN, a quarter of smokers quit within a year or two of menthol bans, researchers find. Menthol cigarette bans are effective at getting people to quit smoking, new research finds. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration has said that a menthol ban is a top priority, but public health advocates have accused the Biden administration of dragging its feet, and the ban has gotten caught up in election year politics, despite research showing clear health benefits. The new research, published last Wednesday in the journal Nicotine and Tobacco Research, looked at studies that have examined the effects of bans in more than 170 U.S. localities, two states, several countries, and the European Union. The pooled results show that about a quarter of menthol smokers quit within a year or two when the substance is banned from cigarettes. National bans seem to be the most effective, the study showed. Menthol cigarette smoking rates were lower in settings with national bans and highest when they were only local or statewide bans. Contrary to claims by the tobacco industry, we did not see an increase in the use of illicit products, study co-author Dr. Sarah Mills said. This review provides compelling evidence that the U.S. Food and Drug Administration should move forward with banning the sale of menthol cigarettes, said Mills, an assistant professor in the Department of Health Behavior at the Gilling School of Public Health. Smoking is the number one cause of preventable deaths in the U.S. Even if just a quarter of menthol smokers quit, it could improve the health of thousands and thousands of people. Among the number of people who smoke cigarettes in the Although the number of people who smoke cigarettes in the U.S. has fallen to one of the lowest levels in history, the proportion of those who smoke menthols has been increasing, according to the CDC. And the number of quitters among some demographics, including older people, have fallen flat. A ban would be of particular help to the health health of communities of color and the LGBTQ plus community, both of which have been targeted by industry advertising for decades. A 2020 study showed that although 40% of all adult smokers smoke menthols, more than 83% of black smokers did. And a CDC study found that while 29% of heterosexual people smoked menthols, 36% of LGBT smokers did. Menthol-flavored cigarettes are particularly appealing to children, studies show, so a ban could also stop new smokers from ever starting. More than half of kids who smoke choose menthol cigarettes, according to the CDC. Studies have found that children who smoke menthols were more likely to become regular smokers than occasional smokers. Menthol itself isn't addictive, but menthol cigarettes are more attractive to new smokers because the flavoring masks the harsh taste and smell that may put off some new smokers. Menthol also anesthetizes the throat, making it easier to deeply inhale the dangerous smoke. When added to cigarettes, menthol sweetens the poison of nicotine, which makes it easier to start smoking and also much harder to quit, Mills said. Black adults die at significantly higher rates than white adults from smoking-related illnesses, including stroke, heart disease, and lung cancer. Black people make up 12% of the population in the U.S., but the community accounts for 41% of smoking-related premature deaths and 50% of the life years lost associated with menthol tobacco product use between 1980 and 2018. And if menthols were banned, the gap between black and white lung cancer deaths would close within 5 years, a Council on Foreign Relations study found. So a very important public policy issue in waiting. And next up, getting to some of the information or misinformation that's been holding up this policy, this from Medical Express. Poll shows strong support among black voters for menthol's ban. Black voters support a ban on menthol cigarettes by a wide margin, refuting claims that such a ban would be strongly opposed by black Americans, a new survey shows. Black voters support, by a 37-point margin, the menthol ban proposed by the U.S. FDA, with 62% in favor and 25% against. That's even greater than the 29% margin by which all voters support the ban, with 58% in favor and 29% against. So it's kind of hard to think that it's some racist proposition if blacks support it more than the overall population. Implementing the rule would not harm President Joe Biden's chances of re-election, the poll found. There was no change in Biden's overall standing after voters were asked to assume his administration ended the sale of menthol cigarettes. There's clear evidence that the menthol rule has no meaningful electoral impact, concluded the Mellman Group, a leading political research firm that conducted the poll on behalf of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. In December 2023, the Biden administration announced it was delaying until March a long-planned ban on menthol cigarettes. The ban has been opposed by some civil rights leaders with ties to big tobacco, who argued it would give police an excuse to target black smokers. And you'll note that the civil rights leaders that are opposing it are ones with direct ties to big tobacco, i.e. money. Media reports said that a poll commissioned by tobacco giant Altria also influenced the administration's decision to delay the ban. The Altria poll, presented to the administration but never publicly released, claimed that the menthol rule would, quote, turn off Biden's core voters, defined as non-white voters and non-conservative white voters under 45. The new poll asked respondents an initial presidential horse race question between Biden and former President Donald Trump. Biden had a 2-point lead over Trump, 44% to 42%. When asked to assume Biden went through with the ban, those polled still gave Biden a 2-point lead over Trump, 45% to 43%. These poll results demonstrate that voters, especially black voters, strongly supported eliminating menthol cigarettes, and they debunk the tobacco industry myth that moving forward will be a political liability, Yolanda Richardson, president CEO of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, said. The Biden administration must issue a final rule without further delay, Richardson continued. There's no other single action the administration can take that would do more to advance health equity and help achieve the goals of the president's cancer moonshot. This new data proves what we already know to be true. Black voters want to see a menthol ban, said Derek Johnson, president and CEO of the NAACP. Now it's time for the Biden administration to put people over profits and swiftly enact a rule that will save countless black lives, Johnson said. We're done waiting. The NAACP will continue to do everything in its power to hold this administration accountable to their promises to our community. Enough is enough. Our lives are at stake. And just sort of a side note in that, the reference to meeting the goals of the president's cancer moonshot. I'll just remind listeners that, of course, that's a big thing that that President Biden has touted as a health initiative. But the cancer moonshot depends far more on prevention than it does on fancy cancer treatments. And, of course, preventing smoking in the first place or helping people quit is by far the best way to reduce cancer rates in the United States. But, hey, there's plenty of misinformation out there. In this case, the misinformation that was trying to leverage fear about this menthol ban had to do with police activity that would be generated against black communities in an alleged wake of activity that a menthol ban might bring about. And like reported in the other story, there was not any increase in getting around a ban. And that's the particular beauty of a national ban. If you have these local bans, then people might do things trying to get menthol cigarettes elsewhere and stuff. But if you ban it everywhere, it cuts down on that a whole lot, apparently to a non-significant level. And I say that with no financial interest. But hey, again, disinformation is alive and well out there. Be careful, folks. The following message contains just enough truth to scare just enough people to scare just about everyone. Dihydrogen monoxide exposure is rampant across the globe. Dihydrogen monoxide is found at high concentrations wherever life is found. You cannot escape it. Did you know that more people have died after recent exposure to dihydrogen monoxide than have died from any of the leading causes of death? What kind of conspiracy is this that so-called experts dismiss so casually? What you will never hear is that virtually every public health expert will concede privately that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide in the days before death is commonplace. However, publicly, virtually every public health expert will deny that exposure to dihydrogen monoxide is a leading cause of death. While dihydrogen monoxide is literally raining down on us, their silence is thunderous. Don't let broad scientific consensus water down these alarming facts. Our fear is real, and our privilege. Tell your friends about the dihydrogen monoxide conspiracy before it's too late. This dire warning has been brought to you by the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, where we explain everything as there is nothing to it. Here at the H2 Oh My God Confederacy, we know in our gut that without dihydrogen monoxide, drinking the Kool-Aid would be impossible. Okay, well, next up we turn to a drug that can't hope to compete with the number of Americans that are killed by cigarette smoking through the addiction to nicotine. But of course, this drug also leads to much devastation and death in the U.S. This from Axios. America's drug overdose crisis has profound ripple effects. More than 4 in 10 Americans personally know someone who has died of an overdose, and an estimated 13% of the population have had their lives disrupted as a result, according to a new study in the American Journal of Public Health. With more than 100,000 people dying from overdoses each year, America's drug crisis has undeniably altered millions of lives. But the study suggests that the epidemic's reach into Americans' life has, if anything, been underestimated. Most who reported knowing someone who died of an overdose said they actually knew multiple people who died from drugs. Although there's limited research specifically on the impact of overdose losses, traumatic bereavement in general is known to have an adverse impact on physical health, mental health, and substance use. Future research should look at overdose death contagion, the authors note. Research on suicide loss may be instructive, the paper notes, and suicide postvention for those left behind is an important part of suicide prevention. So as the opioid epidemic continues, and of course it's a multi-drug overdose epidemic, which is making it much more complicated, particularly for trying to revive people when they have more than one drug, the Narcan and such drugs to help relieve an overdose are not as effective. So that's getting more and more dangerous. And as it's moving into more and more places, particularly for young people who may be taking, you know, ADH drugs or anything, you know, you get off the internet, might have fentanyl or other dangerous synthetic opioids. Okay, well, next up, I want to switch gears here and do a couple stories that get at how persistent environmental health problems can be. This from the Environmental Health Network. Tuna's mercury levels remain unchanged despite environmental efforts. Scientists have observed stable mercury levels in tuna for more than 5 decades, despite environmental regulations reducing mercury emissions. The persistence of mercury in tuna is attributed to historic emissions that continue to affect ocean ecosystems. This phenomenon raises concerns about the long-term impact of legacy pollutants on marine life and human health. Human activities have led to widespread mercury contamination that persists in popular seafood like tuna. Mercury, primarily from human activities like coal-fired power plants and heavy industry, is found even in the deepest ocean trenches, contaminating creatures like snailfish and crustaceans. So even when relatively effectively addressing some of these sources of mercury in the environment, because they're persistent pollutants, it can take decades and decades, perhaps generations and generations, to actually get down to much lower levels in some ecosystems. Tuna in particular are high on the food chain, so they're eating fish that are eating fish, and the bioaccumulation of mercury is large. Okay, well, next up's a somewhat similar story in that the long-term efforts to get toxins out of the environment can take very long. This also from the Environmental Health Network. Toxic chemicals found in recycled flooring materials. A recent study reveals alarming levels of phased-out toxic chemicals, including lead and phthalates, in recycled flooring products. Researchers in Switzerland discovered that 16% of polyvinyl chloride, PVC, flooring products contained banned chemicals. The study highlighted the presence of lead and DEHP, a plasticizer linked to various health issues. The findings underscore the challenges in ensuring safe recycling practices for building materials. If you want to make sure you have clean materials, you need screening tools, said Helene Weisinger, a doctoral student at the Institute of Environmental Engineering at the Swiss Federal Institute of Technology. This discovery points to the need for stringent recycling protocols to prevent harmful substances from re-entering consumer markets, particularly in products used in our homes. And of course, this is also akin to the toxicity that certain plastics put in the recycling stream, if you get even a small amount mixed in, it ruins the whole batch and makes it toxic. Okay, well, next up, another story on exposure to toxic compounds. This is also from the Environmental Health Network. Personal care products may reduce success of IVF treatments. That's in vitro fertilization treatments. Common personal care products may reduce the success of IVF treatments. A recent study published in Frontiers in Endocrinology found that the regular use of personal care products, such as skincare and cosmetics, is linked to a higher possibility of negative in vitro fertilization outcomes. Women undergoing IVF who use cosmetics one or two times per week had a higher chance of miscarriage than those who did not use cosmetics at all. Women who use skincare products were less likely to produce mature eggs for fertilization. This is the first study to examine the relationship between personal care product routines and IVF outcomes. Personal care products contain a number of endocrine-disrupting chemicals that could potentially affect the reproductive function of women in childbearing age. Why does this matter? Personal care products encompass a massive category of consumer goods, including everything from cosmetics to toiletries, soaps, shampoos, hair coloring products, and more. They're also known to contain a variety of hazardous endocrine-disrupting chemicals, like BPA, phthalates, and parabens, which can be absorbed through the skin. With 15% of couples suffering from infertility globally, the authors of the study point out the need for regulations that account to exposure to multiple endocrine-disrupting chemicals in products and their combined effects. But of course, reining in a whole collection of industries that use tens of thousands of compounds, of which the vast majority aren't even studied, can be very difficult.
And now, a message from our lack of sponsors. Do you suffer from moderate to severe disenchantment from rampant capitalism running the lives of you and your loved ones? From daily sexism that can't be mansplained away? From endemic racism that nobody seems to see? Try Eliminol. It's the blue pill from Placebo Pharmaceutical Corporation. It's everything you think it is. The blue pill is a choice you'll never need to feel bad about ever again. Warning, use of Eliminol may lead to addiction in conjunction with a profound sense of not caring that you are addicted, or caring for much of anything else at all, for that matter. If you have any residual concerns, call our lifelong customer hotline, 1-800-CALLUS. Call us whenever, callous always. We now return you to your regular programming, bringing you non-commercial radio, featuring locally produced content and fresh perspectives from non-corporate persons. Good luck with that.
Okay, well, next up, let's turn to a story that gets at the fact that even if we have an effective treatment, if it's at all expensive, globally, worldwide, there's going to be huge disparities in who actually has access to it. So this from Medical Express, revealing global barriers to curative Hep C treatment access. Almost 90% of the 57 million people worldwide living with hepatitis live in low and middle-income countries, but only half of these countries currently provide curative treatments at an accessible cost, according to a study by UNSW Kirby Institute. The finding is part of an analysis published in The Lancet Gastroenterology and Hepatology, which has examined the registration, reimbursement, and restrictions for hepatitis C treatments across 160 countries globally. These countries represent approximately 95% of the global population. Current direct-acting antiviral treatments cure hepatitis C in more than 95% of people, revolutionizing the way we manage this condition. But there remains a high cost to the treatment in most countries, which has led to a disparate rollout globally, with many countries placing restrictions both on who can access it and who can prescribe it, said Dr. Allison Marshall, who led the research. Universal access to health coverage means all people should have access to the full range of quality services they need, irrespective of who they are, where they are born, or the nature of their health condition. According to the research, of the 160 countries analyzed, 91% have at least one hepatitis C treatment registered, but only two-thirds of countries provide their residents with access to reimbursed or subsidized treatment. Among low and middle-income countries, just over half provide reimbursement. Seven countries restrict access based on drug use, and five based on alcohol use. Given that the majority of people living with hepatitis C live in low and middle-income countries, we need to see much higher numbers of countries providing reimbursement for hepatitis C therapies, especially if we are to meet the World Health Organization target to to eliminate hepatitis C as a public health threat by 2030, says Dr. Marshall. Most people living with hepatitis C globally are marginalized and face multiple challenges to accessing care. If cost is a barrier to seeking a cure, they are unlikely to seek treatment, which poses risk for their health as well as for onward transmission. Yeah, I think eliminating hepatitis C as a threat by 2030, unfortunately, that target is very unlikely to be met. But hey, we can do better. Okay, well, next up, getting back to the United States, which spends more resources on healthcare than any other country on the planet, we have this from MedPage Today. Are doctors happy about all this? How many docs are feeling burned out? Almost all of them, surveys find. Almost all physicians regularly experience burnout, and more than half have considered leaving or no longer seeing patients, surveys found. A total of 93 of approximately 1,000 physicians surveyed online said they feel burned out regularly. They also report working an average of 15 hours per week outside their regular workday during, quote, pajama time. More than half of the survey participants, that is 56%, said they thought about either staying in medicine but no longer seeing patients or leaving the field entirely, the poll found. In terms of their daily routine, nearly half of those polled said their daily workload is unsustainable. More than half of respondents, 57%, said they didn't have enough time to spend with patients, with women agreeing with that statement more often than men, 84% of women versus 62% of male doctors. In addition, 77% of respondents said much of their time is dedicated to non-reimbursable tasks, such as getting prior authorizations or filling out insurance forms. Overall, nearly two-thirds, that is 64% of those polled, said they felt overwhelmed by administrative requirements and burdens. More than three-fourths of respondents said they felt overwhelmed by excessive communications demands, such as responding to emails, phone calls, and text messages, with 60% of those polled saying they are expected to respond to patient communications at all hours of the day, every day of the week. So even if you're a high-level professional, expect to be treated like a wage slave. Perhaps we could try a different way, something that doesn't lock us into the endless vicious cycle of profit-making over patient care.
It started in Norway in 1912, and they won't stop until everybody has healthcare. The infestation of healthcare for all has spread to dozens of nations. It could descend upon us from the north at the hands of those crafty Canadians. No wall can keep them out. It could rise up from the south, from those colluding Cubans just 90 miles away. Either might export their higher life expectancy and trample our God-given right to die prematurely. It's what Jesus would do. They're coming to take away your deductibles and copays. They will annihilate out-of-network providers. Protect your right to bet your loved one's health on for-profit healthcare conglomerates and the loving care of pharmaceutical corporations. Who cares if we pay twice as much for sicker citizens than nations who assure healthcare for all? That's just the price of freedom. The best deal ever. Better to pay extortion prices to corporate persons than pay even half that amount in taxes to the government of these somewhat United States. Think about it. Your neighbor could get healthcare whenever they need it. So could casual acquaintances. Even your political enemies would be indiscriminately spared preventable deaths. Don't let them take away our freedom to be sick without healthcare. Now, back to your community programming, powered by community togetherness.
You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo, We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. My guarantee to you is if you listen to this show for a year, you will know more about public health than 99% of the population. And if this shouldn't be the case, I'll be happy to refund you triple your money back. Okay, well, next up, let's get at an interesting connection of health issues. A, Climate change and mental health. This is from Medical Express. Climate change linked to rise in mental distress among teens, finds study. Worsening human-induced climate change may have effects beyond the widely reported rising sea levels, higher temperatures, and impacts on food supply and migration, and may also extend to influencing mental distress among high schoolers in the United States. According to a representative survey of almost 39,000 high school students from 22 public school districts in 14 U.S. states, a quarter of those adolescents who had experienced the highest number of days in a climate disaster within the past 2 years and the past 5 years, such as hurricanes, floods, tornadoes, drought, and wildfire, had a 20% higher odds of developing mental distress than their peers who experienced few or no disaster events. The paper is the first large-scale research looking at the mental health of adolescents following multiple disaster events, including the timing, frequency, and duration of the events, spanning 83 federally declared climate disasters occurring within 10 years before the survey was completed. The findings, using May 2019 data on sadness and hopelessness and short sleep from the U.S. Youth Risk Behavior Survey and disaster data from the Federal Emergency Management Agency, were published this month in the journal Preventive Medicine Reports. Respondents reported mental health distress by responding affirmatively to persistent feelings of sadness or hopelessness and short sleep duration, two factors that previous studies strongly linked to mental health disorders among adolescents. The group controlled for other factors that may influence mental health, such as age, race, gender, experiencing of bullying, concerns about school safety, and household income. We found the strongest effect on mental distress in the 2 years immediately following a climate disaster, with the effect gradually weakening 5 to 10 years after the disaster, said co-author Josiah Kephart, an assistant professor in the Drexel University School of Public Health. Already, roughly half of adolescents have experienced a mental health disorder in their childhood or teen years, according to the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. So, of course, children are particularly vulnerable, and we're having a youth mental health crisis, and climate change is only apparently adding to that. And, of course, responding either effectively or not, the medical system is responding to youth mental health crisis. This from the journal Pediatrics. Antidepressant dispensing to U.S. adolescents and young adults from 2016 to 2022. Between 2016 and 2022, the monthly antidepressant dispensing rate increased 66%. The monthly antidepressant dispensing rate increased 64% faster from March 2020 onwards compared with beforehand. Antidepressant dispensing of adolescents and young adults was rising before the COVID-19 outbreak and rose 64% faster afterwards. This change was driven by increased antidepressant dispensing to females, and the overall increase occurred despite decreasing dispensing to male adolescents. So we actually saw prescribing go down for male adolescents, and this huge increase was all driven by more antidepressant dispensing to female adolescents. Can we drug our way out of a youth mental health crisis? That remains to be seen. I am skeptical.
And now for a word from our lack of sponsors. PR Medica and Merciless Health are rated in the top 100 in clinical excellence in some category that hopefully covers the healthcare you might be able to access. Warning, such excellence may be severely limited by being delivered in the least effective and most expensive sick care system among the so-called advanced economies. While you may be privileged enough or lucky enough to get access to excellent care, your community overall is poorly served. Any such clinical excellence is best taken with a double dose of advocacy for universal health care. This program is not sponsored by PR Medica or Merciless Health. PR Medica and Merciless Health are unwholly owned subsidiaries of Tourette's Industries, ensuring that you will swear by them, whether you like it or not. And now, back to your irregular programming.
Okay, well, last up in the regular reporting for this episode, I'd like to talk about a story that is a good example of public health, in this case, public health nutrition. Public health really looks at entire populations as the patient rather than, for instance, in contrast to medical care, where you're just looking at a particular patient. And you're looking at all the factors within that population and the entire ecosystem, both social and biological, that they reside in, to look at social determinants, health, etc. So this next story from Food Politics. The United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization is taking the lead on bringing dietary guidelines into the 21st century. It is calling for national dietary guidelines not only to be nutrient-based and food-based, but food system-based. So our current food guidelines, dietary guidelines, are basically to help individuals decide how personally they can perhaps improve their own health. This is opposed to food systems-based. So food system-based guidelines extend beyond food-based guidelines that provide advice on foods, food groups, and dietary patterns to provide the nutrients required to the general public to promote overall health and prevent chronic diseases. Food system-based guidelines not only address health and nutritional priorities, but also consider sociocultural, economic, and environmental sustainability factors. This is a huge advance. It means that sustainability issues are essential components of dietary advice. From now on, dietary guidelines that do not consider sustainably are considered out of date. Note, by order of Congress, the 2015 to 2020 dietary guidelines, the previous ones, did not consider sustainability in its meat recommendations, and sustainability was off the table for the 2020 to 2025 dietary guidelines, and also for the 2025 to 2030 version now underway. This means the new guidelines issued in 2025 will be dated and largely irrelevant to the modern era before they're even published. All of this gets at that puzzling conundrum of how much good does it do to be nutritionally healthy on a perhaps dying planet. Okay, well, that brings us to our last regular feature, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all of the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give the link again at the end of the list. I have 24 stories to get to, so let's get to it. First up, the rising costs of the oil industry slow death as unplugged oil and gas wells accelerate climate change, threaten public health, and risk hitting taxpayers' pocketbooks. So this is sort of related to some of the stories I reported on in the regular reporting about how these long changes, whether it's getting rid of toxic chemicals or such in the environment, in this case, reducing climate change by getting rid of fossil fuels, that there's a lot of things that have to be juggled, and you have to be careful to take care of all the things, plug all the things that are unplugged, in this case, oil and gas wells, to make sure that that goes well and successfully. So there are thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands, actually tens of thousands of unplugged oil and gas wells in the U.S. That are leaking air pollution and greenhouse gases. And of course, partly because this is going to take some effort and some money, one of the many reasons why we don't do things is because it costs a lot, and I'm trying to ignore it, just like we've ignored climate change for decades, is just another drain and drag on being able to shift from fossil fuels to renewable energy. And sort of in that same vein, bonus article 2, America is replacing its pipes, and ductile iron pipe is a good alternative for plastic. So this is a follow-up and a continuing coverage of a story that I've reported on before. PVC plastic has toxicity both in the production and the use of it. But this is another example of where, in most cases, ductile iron pipe is actually a better alternative than plastic. One thing, plastic is a problem in a lot of soils. It doesn't hold up as well, and it gets torn up. But even in most situations, the iron pipe lasts double or more the amount of time than PVC plastic does. But of course, if you're looking for short-term costs, even though it might be cheaper in the long run, meaning decades or generations, if you can save money up front, that kind of short-sightedness seems to be one of the trademarks of America. And the difference we're talking about in cost between running a foot of plastic pipe versus iron pipe is relatively marginal, like maybe even 10%. But then, of course, it lasts twice as long. So you can see, offers a lot of advantages. But the way that business has been done in replacing pipes, we have to rethink rather wholesale about how we're going to do that. Okay, and another big thinking article, bonus article 3. Some experts worry California wildlife could be vulnerable to an avian flu apocalypse. So this is a continuing coverage on avian flu. The new thing here is that in South America, there has been huge, basically, apocalypses of seals where you've had entire kill-offs. So usually what happens when mammals get the avian flu, it's because they eat birds that are infected. They're not sure exactly why you're getting entire kill-offs, but the one of the possibilities is that it's transmitting from mammal to mammal, which is much more dangerous. Now, of course, this raises the specter of mammal-to-mammal transmission that may eventually include humans, which could be very dangerous since avian flu in humans, historically, even though there's not a lot of cases, it has happened. And when it happens, it actually has been deadly a fairly amount of time. It'll kill you more likely than COVID will, for instance. So whether this is just a huge problem for California's wildlife, for instance, on the coast, whether it's and all of the cascading effects that if you were to kill seal or sea otter populations, you have a huge effect on the biodiversity and the ecosystem, and those cascading effects could be potentially very dangerous and chaotic. Okay, bonus article 4. More than half the world faces high measles risk, World Health Organization says. Of course, if you're an optimist, you could say almost half of the world maintains good protection from measles. So, of course, they're saying below high measles risk, I guess. Well, this is another story that's been unfolding, unfortunately not in a positive direction. Immunization for measles has to be maintained at high levels to keep population herd immunity. You have to have immunization levels around 95%. And it's dropped down in most of the places of the world is below that, and sometimes substantially more, which means you could have community transmission. And measles is one of the most highly contagious infections in the world and can be very, very deadly. And of course, it affects primarily children, and the deadliness also applies to children. Bonus article 5, deadly synthetic opioid detected in wastewater for the first time. So these new like fentanyl-like derivatives are getting actually more powerful, meaning at teeny, teeny little, I mean, just parts per trillion in water can barely be detected, that now they're starting to detect these in wastewater. Of course, we've known for years and years that many drugs of all types that we urinate out into the water and into the environment even affects, you know, marine ecosystems with the amount of drugs we're pouring in there. We get to add new ones to it now, these new deadly synthetic opioids, which of course are very powerful at very tiny, tiny doses. One of the reasons why having the overdose epidemic that we have here is because it's hard to control the amount of dose and you can easily get overdose. Bonus article 6. Research finds collective downturn in Europe's psychological well-being following the outbreak of war in Ukraine. So this is perhaps self-evident, and this was a very interesting design study where they were really following in real time over days and weeks, and most of this downturn psychologically in Europe was in the first months, weeks, days and weeks of the outbreak of the war in Ukraine. And there was a recovery in most people, except for those people that are most vulnerable. There was a more persistence to it. But also, the size of the effect of this drop was actually greater than what we saw when the COVID-19 pandemic hit, when there was a lot of uncertainty, you know, with the worldwide pandemic. Now, of course, that lasted longer than what they're defining as the period of the beginning of the outbreak of the war. But it's just shows you the powerful effect that it had by comparison. And in another interesting story about Ukraine and war, bonus article 7, war zone or not, Ukraine seeks to reclaim its role as a hub for clinical trials. So whether you don't know if you know that or not, but Ukraine has historically been a hub for clinical trials. And since much of the country is pretty much out of shooting range, they want to return to normal and try to restart a lot of these clinical trials. Of course, there's some skepticism around it, but an interesting contrast and story on the many facets of the effects of war. Just one small effect. Bonus article 8, what the science says about time-restricted eating. So this is a more on a personal health thing. And this is really important because the overwhelming majority of people, not only about 10% of people actually go 12 hours between the time they eat the last thing from the day before to the first thing they eat the next day. That is considered time-restricting eating if you go 12 hours or more. So 10% or less of the population is actually meeting that definition of time-restricted eating. We pretty much graze and eat the whole time that we're awake. That seems to be the DNA of America's eating habits. So what does the science say? In short, basically, time-restricted eating is good, whether that's 12 hours or 16 hours. You can get most of the benefits by 12. And also, earlier in the day is better. If you're eating the exact same diet, but you're moving for the amount of food and the timing earlier in the day, you actually get a better health benefit. Bonus article 9. New research reinforces importance of boosting potassium for blood pressure control. So in recent shows, I've done some stories on trying to use a potassium chloride mix with a sodium chloride, which is salt, which is like table salt. And if you put a proportion of that as potassium chloride, it can help cut down on the sodium, but it could also boost potassium. And this is a new study that shows that actually it looks like the boosting potassium is even more important than the reducing the sodium in that particular intervention where you're substituting just table salt, which is all sodium chloride, with table salt that includes a proportion of potassium chloride. And of course, potassium is widely available in fruits and vegetables and is the best way to get your potassium. And just boosting that can be really important for blood pressure control. Bonus article 10, women may realize health benefits of regular exercise more than men. So this is some good news for women, maybe bad news for men, depends how you look at it. But women get the benefits either from disease prevention or actual mortality, doing about half as much exercise as men. So, hey, that's just the way it is. Our physiologies are different. Bonus article 11, maternal mental conditions drive their climbing death rate in the U.S. So maternal mortality rates in the U.S. are the highest among industrialized countries. And I've reported on this before, that when you look at mental conditions, psychiatric conditions, or substance use conditions, or if you even want to throw in violence, that's where most of this increased death, and most of that is actually outside of what can be dealt with well in the medical system. Again, social determinants of health that require a more societal-wide response rather than just changing our medical care system. Bonus article 12. Child tax credits provide significant relief to families experience economic shocks during COVID. So this is just another example of how basic income support can blunt the worst effects. And this is particularly on families with kids, since kids are the most vulnerable and younger families tend to have poor economic status, just starting out in life and such. Bonus article 13 related to that, similarly, those getting eviction notices during COVID pandemic at greater risk for death. Again, basic housing, having housing, whether it's good quality or not, is really important for maintaining our basic health. And even the threat of getting an eviction notice can have effect on your health. And even getting a threat of eviction notices can get you evicted because a lot of people can't even defend an eviction, whether it's rightfully or wrongfully brought. Bonus article 14. Towards solving the long COVID puzzle, latest advances. So, of course, a lot of people are still dealing with COVID because they have long COVID, which can last for years and years. We don't know exactly how long. A lot of it's probably like chronic fatigue syndrome and such, which can last for years and years and years. But this is a very good summary of some of the latest advances. And that's the one good thing, is that since millions of people are affected with long COVID, they are pouring a lot of resources and quickly trying to find better ways to diagnose and treat long COVID. Bonus article 15. Inside the plan to diagnose Alzheimer's in people with no memory problems, and who stands to benefit. So this is basically a team of 20 people have gotten together to make these recommendations. 14 of the 20 have financial conflicts of interest related to Alzheimer's diagnosis or treatment. And basically what they're trying to do is drive the pharmaceutical dream of getting people diagnoses. It's like stage A of Alzheimer's, even though you have no memory problems, and you would expect that the vast majority of those people would never have Alzheimer's. Of course, this would allow for a huge medical diagnostic industry and a pharmaceutical industry to try to address those people with so-called early Alzheimer's. Bonus article 16. In California, face-off between major insurer and health system shows hazards of consolidation. So these are the wars between the big healthcare conglomerates, whether they're health systems or insurers. There's billions and billions of dollars at stake. And unfortunately, patients get caught in the middle of these conflicts where they may get thrown off an insurer or have to change their whole set of doctors if a health system stops using a major insurer. Needs to be something that provides better patient protection. Of course, universal health care would be a good start to that. Bonus article 17. The powerful constraints on medical care in Catholic hospitals across America. I've reported on this before, and I will note that 16% of births in hospitals happen in Catholic hospitals. And there's 10 states that have 30% or more of births in Catholic hospitals. And even Washington State has over 50%. A majority of births are in Catholic hospitals. And Catholics, in Catholic hospitals, they restrict the kind of care that you can get, which can be a problem for a lot of people. Doesn't matter whether you're Catholic or not. You can't get treatment for certain conditions in those facilities. Bonus article 18. If you're poor, fertility treatment can be out of reach. So there's the big story about Alabama determining that embryos are children. And of course, that's created kind of quite a stir around fertility treatment. But of course, fertility treatment itself is something that is very expensive, usually not covered by insurance. So access to IVF procedures varies widely by income and financial resources. Bonus article 19, protecting immigrant children, a public health of consequence. So this is an American Journal of Public Health article, and it's a good narrative review if you want to get an idea of the just unending series of challenges that immigrant children face. It's kind of haunting, but that's a good read. Bonus article 20, why doctors avoid talking with patients about gun safety. So this is a good example where politicization gets in the way of public health. Patients don't necessarily want to talk it. Doctors don't want to talk about it. There's little reason in the system to push for integration of assessment and education and counseling around that. A lot of doctors didn't even know that the system that they were in was asking assessment questions about, like, you know, do you have guns? Do you store them safely and stuff? So, you know, you're wasting people's time. And of course, about half of patients don't even answer those questions, even though they fill out the rest of the assessment. So obviously it's very politically charged. So just kind of lays out the problems that we have with talking even about gun safety in a healthcare setting. Bonus article 21, artificial intelligence is making critical healthcare decisions. The sheriff is MIA. So there are already AI uses in healthcare. Many of them are fairly critical, but they're not being properly evaluated and they're not being standardized or regulated in any way. So we need something like from the FDA or whoever to be able to assess the effectiveness and safety, lack of bias of those particular interventions, AI interventions. Of course, next up in bonus article 22, when it comes to data. Healthcare data breaches hit 1 in 3 Americans last year. Is your data vulnerable? So this is something that when we start getting the rise of AI, you could very well have AI weaponized both to attack systems and to potentially defend systems. So the robot wars begin. But there are plenty of cases where entire health systems have been shut down. This story talks about prescriptions not being able to be filled because they were breached. Bonus Article 23, Crisis in Gaza, Scenario-Based Health Impacts Projections. So this was a study that looked at what would happen whether we had a ceasefire, whether you continued the situation pretty much as it is with only modest improvement, or whether you had an invasion of Rafah, an escalation, which of course is what Israel says is going to do. And basically what you do is you have 75,000 lives in the balance over the next 6 months. There's already been over 30,000 deaths in this war. This study also shows that currently about 1 in 8 children under the age of 5 are suffering starvation, are wasting. Within 3 months, that'll double to 1 in 4. Within 6 months, that'll be the majority of children under 5 will be starving, wasting. Of course, from a public health point of view, a ceasefire and 75,000 lives would be the preference. Well, on a little bit of a good note, I guess, on that front, the last article, bonus article 24, as catastrophe grips Sudan, heroic midwives help women deliver babies in a war zone. So Sudan is also experiencing a huge crisis, but you have heroic midwives that are, in fact, providing midwifery services to women in a war zone. Whoa. If you want to read about this or any of the other stories I've reported on, you can go to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive, and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-